This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That
all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and with me in studio is Carey Jr. II. He is the show's producer.
How you doing, Stephen?
Good. How are you?
I am well. I'm ready to get some more insight on why stuff costs so much.
I say, it's the thing that everyone's talking about. It's the thing everyone's thinking about, especially as we get closer to an election. How come everything is so darned expensive?
I thought we already answered the question. We thought inflation was the issue. We thought it was COVID,
right?
Post-COVID, the industry,
yeah.
Supply chain being interrupted, and the interest rates going up. We figured that was the whole reason that
and costs are so high. There's no question that that's part of the reason that things got to be where they are. But our guest today says there's something else going on, and it's kind of an old school concept in American capitalism, greed.
Yeah.
Our guest today is Bilal Baydoun. He's the director of policy and research at the Groundwork Collaborative, which is a think tank that tries to take a look at economic trends and theory and figure out how to make things better, especially for working class people. Bilal gave Senate testimony before the Senate Banking Committee to talk about corporate price gouging, which is what he says is driving all of the money that we're spending on things.
And it's not just raising the prices. It's also, he says, the way that they do it. By that, I mean, during inflation, when we actually have real inflation, it kind of creates in the populace, we're thinking, okay, let's blame it on inflation. Everything's so high because of pandemic, like I said before, pandemic interest rates going up. And so at that point, prices go up, but then these companies can maintain those high prices even when inflation has trended down. And so that is kind of their way of, it can be a way of masking these high prices with inflation. And then there's all the ways that he talks about it can be done. And then he talks about how technology plays a role. So he has a really interesting perspective in this in this testimony. And I'll be interested to hear what he has to say in this conversation, bringing all that in and letting our listeners know how all this stuff kind of snowballs into this one big financial burden.
I mean, one of the things that I'm eager to talk to Bilal about is the connection between what industry is doing with setting prices and what big data is doing with getting as much information about us as possible. What they're doing with the pricing wouldn't be possible without the data that we voluntarily, quite honestly, give up every day when we sign into apps or are on social media or even purchase things. We are telling on ourselves basically how much we would be willing to pay for lots of things. And corporate America is really taking advantage of that. And it wouldn't work without this aid of all this data that didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. Bilal Baydoun, great to have you here in the studio. Welcome to the Created Equal.
It's a pleasure to join you, Stephen. Thank you.
So let's start here. Why is stuff so expensive right now? When I go to the grocery store, if I go anywhere that I have to spend money, reach into my back pocket, pull out my wallet, I put it back a lot lighter than I did a couple of years ago. And I'm not the only person. I hear people talking about this, posting about it on social media all the time. Why is it happening?
Thank you, Stephen. Well, it's the right question to ask. It's the question that most Americans think about every day. Affordability, the high cost of living, is at the forefront of most people's minds, certainly through the last couple of years, but also, of course, during an election year. You know, we went through an inflationary period during the global pandemic. This was a once-in-a-century disruption, economic and obviously health cataclysm. It disrupted global supply chains, which led to a lot of shortages, which led to a rise in prices. There was also a war in Ukraine that unfolded within the same period that affected global food and energy prices. So basically, all of the global supply chains that our global economy relies on to bring goods to market, to deliver services, were snarled, and it took several years for those supply chains to heal and to get back to normal. Now, here's the interesting thing. During that period, and I'm sure there are some small business owners listening to this program. If you're a small business owner and your costs rise, mm-hmm. you might raise the price, right? And you want
to
pass.
You have to. You have to. You got to make up for it.
You got to make up for it, and you want to protect your profit margins. It's hard to compete out here. You have a lot of competition. That's small business. That is not what big business did during the pandemic. What big business did, what the largest corporations did, is they used the, you know, what I just described as these disrupted supply chains as air cover. And by the way, the air cover is not my language. That is a direct quote from a CEO, from the head of research of Barclays Bank, mm-hmm. who said that inflation provided air cover to raise prices. And so essentially what you have today, when you go to the grocery store, when you shop for clothes, when you fill up gas, everywhere you turn throughout the economy, when you pay rent, what you're seeing is companies have rolled out these very risky pricing strategies that are essentially gouging consumers. And the reason that they rolled out these pricing strategies, which we're happy to get into in this conversation, mm-hmm. Is because people were desperate. People had little place else to turn. And so when you go to the grocery store in the middle of a pandemic and you see that toilet paper is, you know, however much more than it was, you're going to pay that price. Companies fully understood that, and they decided to go for the home run, and they did. The post-pandemic period was the most profitable period for American business in 70 years. Mm. I mean, think about that. In the throes of one of the darkest chapters in this country's history, over a million people died from the pandemic. That was also the most profitable period for corporate America. So if you want to talk about the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street, right. I don't think any period really demonstrated that more.
So I want to go back to something you were just talking about, the distinction between small businesses and big businesses. You say that if you own a small business and the cost of doing business goes up, you don't have a choice but to pass that on to your customers.
Sure.
Why should it be different for big businesses, or why is it different? How do we know that, for instance, the higher price of doing business, the disrupted supply chains, didn't also force big business to raise its prices?
Sure. Well, again, let's say it really comes down to one factor, competition. Let's say that you're in Metro Detroit and you own a small business. Let's call it, because it's the Motor City, let's call it a tire repair shop.
We don't have any of those.
Yeah, we don't have any of those, right? So think of the sheer volume of tire repair shops. And so if you wanted to pull off something similar, you'd go out of business. If you use the sort of pandemic, the emergency as an opportunity, to hike the prices of tires to an exorbitant level, someone is just going to drive further down Evergreen or down Warren and go to the next one. Mm-hmm. No problem. Mm-hmm. Big business doesn't sort of suffer from the same burden to compete for your business. And that's really central to this story. Over the last couple of decades, 3/4 of American industries, large industries, are more concentrated today than they were a couple decades ago. Mm-hmm. They're dominated by fewer players than they were a few decades ago. This is everything from shipping to banks, grocery retail to meatpacking. I mean, all of these industries are consolidated. So what does that fundamentally mean? There was once an era in this country where large corporations had to compete for your business, had to innovate, had to invent new things, had to hustle, had to market better. They don't have to do that as much anymore. And so that just gives them free rein to raise prices. And this is what we call the company's pricing power. Their pricing power was really enhanced through this era of consolidation, of mergers, of companies getting bigger, stronger, with less competition. And that is the distinguishing factor, I think.
Yeah.
If I could add just one more factor too, large companies, unlike small businesses, have enormous computing power, access to sophisticated technologies that allow them, frankly, to surveil consumers, which is something I think we'll talk about today. that small businesses don't have. You know, the local tire repair shop doesn't know when you get paid. McDonald's might know that, though. If you use the McDonald's app, McDonald's could know when your payday is. And they could theoretically charge you more for a, you know, for a McFlurry the day you get paid, right, as opposed to the day before.
Yeah. This is the marriage, I guess, between big data,
yes,
and big business.
That's
right now.
That's exactly right.
And I do want to talk about that, yeah, in a little bit. What happens with this money that these corporations are charging? These big corporations, as you say, they raise their prices irrespective of cost and irrespective of the other inflationary forces that are working in the economy. And as you point out, they make more money in the post-pandemic period than they did in 70 years. How do we know that's all profit? And why doesn't it then recirculate in the economy? I think a CEO would say to you, well, yeah, we made that money, but I have employees now and I am buying more things from other companies. Why is it bad for business to make that money?
Yeah. Well, where did the money go? I mean, executive pay skyrocketed, stock buybacks skyrocketed. This is basically the practice of, instead of using profits to invest in, you know, future ventures and sort of more production or some other productive capacity that could benefit workers and the economy more broadly, some companies simply buy back their own stock to inflate their stock prices and to make their
stock. You see that a lot.
It really, actually, during this period that we're talking about, stock buybacks exceeded $1 trillion in 2021. That was an all-time high. So you have a situation where, just to establish the causal chain, you know, companies' input costs, what we call their input costs, they did go up during the pandemic. There's no denying that. But companies then raised their prices above and beyond what would be necessary to protect their margins and keep their margins the same. And so that is what we have been calling profiteering. And so they reap record profits as a result. The record profits go into buying back their own stock and paying out enormous dividends, of course. The labor share of income doesn't really go up that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now we're seeing wages sort of outpace inflation a little bit, mm-hmm, but certainly not commensurate with the rise, for example, in CEO pay, mm-hmm, and not keeping up with that on any level, even in terms of percentage growth.
You mean
growth.
I'm not making as much as the chairman of GE?
Unfortunately, Stephen, you're not. But even relative to your own income, you're not. So it's not just sort of a... In total terms. And so that's where the value, I'll tell you also, Stephen, where the money is not going. It's not going to taxes. That would actually be the way to distribute those.
Better throughout the economy.
Better through the, sure. We have a system, you know, we have an age old system of taking, you know, profits and making sure that they're distributed, you know, to the country, to infrastructure, to things that give us a functioning country, social supports, childcare. Of course, the largest companies in this country don't really pay taxes anymore.
They don't pay any taxes.
They don't pay any. A lot of them pay
at the federal level.
At the federal level, a lot of them don't pay very much in tax. This is largely due to the Trump tax reform, mm-hmm, in 2017. But, mm-hmm, of course, corporate taxation has been declining for quite some time. Yeah. And so, you know, I think taxing corporations would be a major, major disincentive to pursue some of these tactics that we're talking about and we'll continue to talk about.
Yeah. I want to talk about the effect this is having on us, the consumers, who are paying these higher prices, and on small business, which is, I think, kind of caught in the middle of maybe these two forces. But let's start with consumers. I mean, like I said, I feel it, you feel it. Anyone who's got to buy things right now is aware of how much they cost. But what is the overall effect of that on the economy from a kind of macro perspective?
Absolutely. Well, we at the Groundwork Collaborative, which is the organization I work, mm-hmm, for, we determined that in the second and third quarters of last year, corporate profits, you know, derived through a lot of these price hikes, accounted for 53% of all inflation. So 53% of all price growth in the economy.
Just went into people's pockets.
Corporate profits was causing that. There are other things that could lead to prices rising, such as the labor share, you know, but that's not what we saw. It's really corporate profits that's driving, that drove over half of inflation during that period. And so I think you do see some of these pricing tactics leading to inflation. But regardless of whether it affects, you know, one technical measure of inflation, like the consumer price index, it's just simply unfair, you know, to go to the grocery store. And I'm sure many of your viewers will relate to this. For those who had those, you know, those playground conspiracy theories, when you open a bag of Doritos, you know, are there less chips than there were? The answer is yes, actually. It's not a conspiracy.
Right. It's true. You're getting less for your money.
Yeah, you're getting less for your money. And so that is just one of the dizzying array of tactics that were deployed during the pandemic. That one is called shrinkflation. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of giving you less product, but charging you the same or a higher price. Right. And so that's real. It's simply unfair, regardless of what the macroeconomic indicator is. Another sort of manifestation of this, Stephen, if you and I both booked separate rooms for separate reasons, but we both booked a room in the Shinola Hotel right now, I don't want to sort of single out the Shinola Hotel. Mm-hmm. Just call it any hotel, a Hyatt, somewhere in the United States. Same time, same city, next door. We could pay different prices for those hotel rooms. That also is just profoundly unfair.
Now, and the reason for that is?
The reason for that is because companies are building what is called, or have access to what is called, your identity graph.
Right.
This is basically—
This is back to the data.
Is back to the data. They know your email, your social media activity, your travel history, your retail history, how long you spend on certain websites. This is surveillance. This is corporate surveillance. If the government were doing this on this scale, people would be outraged. This happens all the time in e-commerce. If you're booking that same hotel room, Stephen, on a Mac and I'm using a PC, you might be charged higher because the company determines that people with Macs have more money.
Right.
How they determine that? These are things we don't have access to, which, by the way, can lead to a lot of discrimination, if you really think about it. Let's say, just to give folks another example, let's say that you know, a large retailer is charging you a price based on your zip code. Now, they're not explicitly saying that that means your race, but in America, that's what it is. Yeah. You know, if I can see that you spend most of your time in, you know, using advanced geolocation, you spend most of your time in 48126. It's not too hard to figure out that you're probably Arab American.
Mm-hmm. You live in Dearborn,
right? You live in 48213. You're probably black.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, although there are laws outlawing, you know, although there it's explicitly illegal to charge somebody a different price based on their race. Well, if you use location as a proxy, it's not hard to imagine where that can lead.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Bilal Baydoun of the Groundwork Collaborative about why we're paying so much for the things we need. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and our guest is Bilal Baydoun. He is the Director of Policy and Research at the Groundwork Collaborative. He recently appeared before the Senate Banking Committee to talk about corporate price gouging. Why are we paying so much more for everything right now in America? Bilal, I do want to dig more into what we were kind of touching on in the first segment of our conversation. This data is not just being used by social media to try to figure out what you want and advertise it to you. It's being used by the corporations themselves to determine what to charge you and when. And I want to talk about how big that is and how dangerous that is in the unregulated way that we are allowing it to happen.
Absolutely, Stephen. You know, for a long time, pricing was sort of a boring part of corporate strategy. I mean, I think most of your listeners would rightly assume that the way pricing should work is you take into account supply and demand, the cost of your materials and input, and maybe a little bit of analysis of what your competitors are doing. Those days are fading away. The new sort of philosophy in corporate America is let's try to figure out the maximum price that each individual person is willing to pay. And I can't stress enough the word individual. Companies collect reams of data about us every single moment that we're on our phones, when we're browsing websites. And really what they're after fundamentally is not our business. They want our data. Our data is immensely profitable. It's immensely valuable. This is part of the reason why a lot of companies offer you discounts if you download the app, right? So McDonald's wants you to download the app, and over 100 million people have. And
let's be honest, that's a really convenient way. If you want McDonald's,
sure.
I mean, it's a great way to get your McDonald's even faster than going through the drive-thru.
Sure. And I'm not discouraging people from using apps. I think it's good to be aware of why they want you to use the app fundamentally. Right.
And what you're telling them by downloading the app and using it.
Exactly right. And so they might dangle an incentive, right? You could get a $3 McMuffin if you use a McDonald's app. That discount is not very expensive for them to offer because what they're getting in return is your data. They are getting, as I mentioned, your email, your social media, your travel history, your retail history. A lot of that is third-party data, but they're also getting, you know, first-party data as well. In the case of McDonald's, as I mentioned, McDonald's would have access to your payday, for example. You could just begin to imagine all of the different scenarios where knowing when you get paid could be used to determine the price you're charged.
Right. And let's talk about how they're getting that. How can McDonald's, because I download their app and use it, how can they tell?
Yeah, look, a lot of it is agreeing to the terms. You know, you see this a lot with Uber, for example. There was a study in Belgium that figured out that people using the Uber app who were in the same place going to the same destination were charged different prices based on how low their battery was. So when you download the Uber app, one thing you agree to is to share things like the status of your battery. And there are so many things like this. Your calendar, you know, it could be birthdays, it could be anything. For a long time, pricing consultants and sort of theorists, I guess, in corporate strategy, used this theoretical idea of what they call perfect price discrimination. Perfect price discrimination. It was a theoretical exercise. This wasn't a real idea. But the idea was, how can we figure out, you know, how much each person's willing to pay so that they pay exactly the price that they should, whether it's high, whether it's low. During the pandemic, that moved from a theoretical exercise to a practical exercise, largely because, as I mentioned earlier, the pandemic sort of shrouded the economy in uncertainty and doubt, and people weren't really asking questions when they're worried about, you know, their grandmother or their aging parents potentially contracting COVID. They weren't thinking about why Coca-Cola was raising the price of a can of Coke. And so, you know, this confluence of, it's really three factors. You called it a marriage between big business and big data. That's absolutely correct. I'd add a third factor in there, which is the cloud cover of the pandemic. It was an opportunity, a once in a century opportunity, unprecedented opportunity to roll out some of these strategies that we're discussing, which they're not new ideas. They're just have never been rolled out precisely because they're so risky. I mean, imagine you're facing stiff competition and consumers find out that you shrunk the size of Gatorade or a chocolate bar. Something like that could be scandalous. And in many cases, it has been scandalous. For example, just this past spring, Wendy's had announced that it was going to install digital digital sort of billboards or you know, the pricing menu would turn digital. And part of the reason why they wanted to do that is to implement a pricing strategy known as surge pricing. Anyone who's used Uber or Lyft mm-hmm. is familiar with surge pricing. Right. We're not used to getting charged surge pricing with cheeseburgers. but you can imagine where this ends, right? It's snowing outside. You're in Michigan. You're not going to go down inside of Wendy's to buy a cheeseburger. You're going to go through the drive-thru. Right. They could very easily charge you more for going through the drive-thru than going inside by using, you know, the digital pricing menu, which allows them to manipulate prices in a nanosecond.
Instantly,
prices. If you're coming off the highway and, you know, there's always those fast food exits and the line starts to really build up, you know, the first person in line and the sixth car in line might be charged a different price.
Right.
So these technologies are very scary. And just to go back to the point of awareness, Wendy's announced that it would be stopping those plans because the outrage was so immense mm-hmm. from the public. Mm-hmm. And so a similar thing happened with Target, with McDonald's. Mm-hmm. McDonald's recently announced that it would be offering value meals, which, Stephen, I thought was the whole brand of McDonald's was to offer value meals.
It's all value.
So you might wonder, why is McDonald's suddenly marketing value meals? It's because it realizes that people are catching on to what's happening. People are very aware of price gouging. When you ask in polls, you know, why are things so expensive? You know, a plurality, in many cases, a majority of people say corporate greed, corporate price gouging.
Yeah. In your Senate testimony, you talked about Amazon and one of these pricing experiments called Project Nessie. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that was.
Sure. Project Nessie was an extremely secretive pricing experiment run by Amazon in which it sort of manipulated prices billions of times. And it worked by sort of surveilling all of the other prices on the internet. And so if Walmart's price went up by a dollar, this algorithm that Amazon deployed would be able to adjust Amazon's price by a dollar mm-hmm. and maybe even a dollar and 2 cents, maybe just slightly more. Mm-hmm. The whole idea was to test how sensitive consumers were to price hikes. This was secret for a reason, because this would cause outrage if people felt like, you know, the price that you pay for, you know, a bottle of Windex on Amazon mm-hmm. was changing a million times a day or 1,000 times a day or 100 times a day even. But what we know is by running this this project, Amazon reaped $1 billion. $1 billion.
Wow.
Simply from this project. And so you can understand why the project was devised in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's immensely profitable to change prices rapidly, depending on, yes, real-time changes in supply and demand, but also depending on who's doing the shopping, which is something that we call personalized pricing, surveillance pricing.
Yeah. In a little bit, I do want to talk more about whether this is a data problem or a business regulation problem or both. But I want to, before we get to that, I want to talk about the danger here to individuals, right? I had a conversation maybe a couple of years ago with someone about how much data is being collected about us all the time and how much we're voluntarily giving it up in many cases by agreeing to these user terms and things like that. And I said, well, if I don't mind, what's the big deal, right? If I don't object to them knowing this about me, what's the risk? And the person I was talking to started to outline the kind of discriminatory instincts that could be fueled by that, the kinds of things that that could be calibrated to cost more that I absolutely have to have, things like my health insurance, right? If your insurer, for instance, were to know more about what you did and where you were, could they charge you more because you seem like more of a risk? We already see that with auto insurance and then looking at things like your credit score, right? Saying, well, if you don't pay your bills, you probably are not a very careful person. And so we need to be more more skeptical of you. But talk about in this case, this marriage between big data and big industry. What the danger is, the real danger to consumers if we just let this run wild the way it has been.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fundamental danger is the end of a fair price in America.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of a fair price, the notion that two people will be charged the same price, regardless of who they are, where they spend their time, their interests, what they talk about online. You know, there's a whole sort of cottage industry of pricing consultants, you know, who are advising companies today to really invest more in this surveillance style pricing, and personalized pricing is the other name for it. And, you know, it's profoundly unfair just on its face. And I think it also just sows deep distrust throughout our society. I mean, we live in a democracy. We expect, rules to be applied fairly and uniformly across the board. When people are being gouged all the time, when they're being deceived, which, by the way, a lot of these strategies really rely on deception. Mm. That is kind of the core value of a lot of these things.
What do you mean by that?
Sure. I think companies recognize very well that if you had equal information to the seller, you would not make a purchase, right? if you knew, for example, that the size of the peanut butter jar had gone down, you might be angry and you might say, I'm not going with this brand anymore. So it's really critical that reduction in peanut butter happen in a way that flies beneath your radar.
You don't notice.
Yeah. Similarly, anyone who's filed for their taxes using TurboTax, for example, you know, in April we had tax day. A lot of these services are marketed as free services. Mm-hmm. We'll help you file for your taxes for free. When you're on page 40 of your tax return, it suddenly tells you
for money.
You got to update to premium now. The reason they do that is because they're playing on the psychology of, you know, I've already invested so much time in this. It's been 40 minutes. You know, do I really want to start over?
My taxes are almost done. I'm not going back to the beginning.
Absolutely. And so that strategy actually has a name. It's called drip pricing.
Hmm.
It's used in other cases too. Think about rentals, which I know is a huge issue in Detroit, housing affordability. Mm-hmm. Rentals are really beset by junk fees. So you might look at a property listing, $1,300 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So you inquire, you go see the place, and then you notice there's a trash fee, and then there is a, you know, service fee, and then there's a pet fee, and there's all these fees that pile up. There are even fees for paying the rent. There's convenience fees for paying the rent online.
Right.
And so by the time you're finished, you know, that rental that was $1,350 is $1,550
right.
now.
Right.
Again, there's psychology involved there. If they list it for $1,550, you might not go and see that place. Mm-hmm. And so deception is really a core value here. You mentioned auto insurance, huge problem here.
Mm-hmm.
The auto insurance companies are also relying on, if not deception, then an asymmetry of information, right? There was a New York Times article recently about General Motors sharing data, driving data with insurance companies.
Yeah.
You might be turning on your car. You might like check a box that says, I agree. You just bought a new car.
Right.
You're not really.
You think you're agreeing to use the GPS.
Sure.
But you're also agreeing to share your data.
Right. And specifically with auto insurance companies who are notorious price gougers. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the last inflation report, auto insurance was up significantly, skyrocketed. I really dug into that on my own to figure out what was justifying this enormous spike in auto insurance. The auto insurance companies give a variety of answers. You know, they say car prices went up, more expensive cars are more expensive to insure. They say that during the pandemic, there were more accidents and there's still some residual risk from that. But in reality, we don't have access to the data that they do to make decisions.
Right.
And so I fear with auto insurance that a similar thing is happening, that at one point it was made to be more expensive to insure cars during the pandemic, but they're still sort of riding on that excuse. And they've kept prices high instead of fairly bringing them back down to a level that accurately reflects the risk.
What's actually going on?
Yeah. You see this a lot with credit cards too. This is something that we've sort of called double greedflation. very wonky term, but just imagine this. Imagine you're going to the grocery store and you buy diapers. We know that the diaper companies price gouged. They raised cost way above the rising cost of their inputs. In diapers, the main input is wood pulp. Mm-hmm. Wood pulp is used to make diapers. The price of wood pulp skyrocketed during the pandemic. There's no denying that. Wood pulp became more expensive. But then it went down. Mm-hmm. Did diaper prices also go down?
They did not go down as much.
Not as much. Not even close. Yeah. And so now imagine you go buy that diaper using a credit card, using a Capital One card, for example. You might be paying 30% interest if you carry a balance on those diapers. And so you got ripped off twice. 30% interest, and you might be charged a late fee.
Right.
That if you miss a payment of $35 or $40. Thankfully, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently issued a rule that says late fees on credit cards cannot exceed $8. Just to give folks a sense of how they arrived at that. Mm-hmm. Late fees are not supposed to be part of the profit model. You're not supposed to make a killing off of late fees. So exploitative.
Yeah.
Late fees, if you asked a random person in the street, why do credit card companies charge late fees? I think they would tell you to incentivize on-time payment. Mm-hmm. But there's already so many other ways to incentivize on-time payment. You could report to the credit bureau. Mm-hmm. You could take away somebody's promotional APR.
Right.
There are all sorts of mechanisms. But these large banks are charging $35 late fees simply because they can, because they're immensely profitable. Yeah. And so you get gouged twice. You get gouged when you buy the diapers. You get gouged when you carry a balance. You get gouged when you miss a payment. And just the total gouging of that over the course of a year or five years or 10 years is extraordinary.
And it is a perpetuator of the cycle of poverty, right?
Absolutely.
People who don't have enough to begin with can't get ahead because it's expensive to be poor. You've got to buy diapers. They're more money. You don't make more money to acquire those diapers. You need this credit card because maybe you don't have enough cash coming into the household every month to buy the diapers. So you're paying 30% interest. Maybe you can't pay the credit card on time because, again, maybe you lost your job or whatever during the pandemic. It all piles on in a way that keeps people at or near the bottom.
Absolutely. And it's always lower income people that bear the brunt of things like junk fees, like these rental fees, like exorbitant credit card APRs, like, late fees, overdraft fees. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that, you know, if you happen to make one purchase that causes you to overdraft, that you have to pay, $30 or $40 or $50 is completely unjustified. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the agency I mentioned earlier, is also working on a rule to curb overdraft fees. By the way, this has caused enormous industry opposition. They are fighting. They are marshaling every resource they have to oppose some of these rules. Yeah. Because a lot of these companies and some of their supporters in Congress are pro junk fees because they know they're profitable.
It's profit.
Yeah, it's profitable. Yeah.
Okay, we need to take another quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some solutions to this kind of greedflation that's driving prices through the roof. We'll be back with more of Bilal Baydoun and Created Equal. We're back to our conversation with Bilal Baydoun, who's the Director of Policy and Research at Groundwork Collaborative. He recently appeared before the Senate Banking Committee to talk about corporate price gouging. And that's what we're talking about here on Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. Okay, so we've got these multiple things going on that are keeping prices high. And at the Ground War Collaborative, you guys talk about it as a symptom of greed, of corporate greed. It's also a symptom of government laxity, let's call it, in dealing with these things, right? So let's start with the just regular old government regulation of industry. It doesn't work the way that it used to.
Absolutely. There are a number of mechanisms. You know, it's not like government is helpless, you know, to address this. There are a number of tools that the government has in its toolkit. Many of these tools, by the way, many of the agencies in this current administration has already begun to use. Mm-hmm. The relevant agencies here, I'm thinking of the Department of Justice's antitrust division. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk much about antitrust, but antitrust is really central. This involves breaking up big concentrations of power mm-hmm. that give companies the pricing power to begin with, to do these kinds of things. So you have the Department of Justice, they have an antitrust division. You have the Federal Trade Commission. You have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which we talked about. And of course, Congress. Mm-hmm. There's several laws that Congress can pass, several laws that have actually already been proposed in Congress that would address some of these practices piece by piece. It's not going to be one legislation that says it's illegal to price discriminate. You have to attack this from all different angles. You start with the privacy piece. It has to be made explicitly illegal to use certain characteristics of people to set prices. Mm-hmm. Call it a blacklist, you know, of factors. You cannot set prices based on someone's ethnicity. That needs to be made painstakingly clear.
Zip code.
Because yeah. of the segregated society
because
that
of
we
the
live
connection
in.
Between mm-hmm. race and ethnicity and where you live.
Absolutely. Shrinkflation, you know, this practice of shrinking the size of a product, charging you the same price or more. There is legislation introduced by Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania mm-hmm. called the Shrinkflation Prevention Act. What this would do is it would classify shrinkflation as what's called an unfair or deceptive act in practice. It's an acronym, UDAP. And what that would do is it would empower the Federal Trade Commission to define shrinkflation and to include it on its list, and it does keep a list, mm-hmm. of deceptive practices. Mm-hmm. And so if you engage in this deceptive practice, you would be opening up yourself to lawsuits, to civil liability. And that obviously would be an enormous disincentive to do it in the first place. France, and just to take examples from other countries, not only do they sort of classify it as deceptive or are thinking about classifying it as deceptive, they also have a labeling policy. So if you go to the grocery store and the peanut butter is smaller, mm-hmm. in France, you would actually have to put a label on
that says this is less.
Yeah. France even allows consumers to report using a consumer reporting app from the government to report products that they suspect are smaller than they were. So that's shrinkflation. There's also a bill from Senator Elizabeth Warren that's called the Price Gouging Prevention Act, which would create a federal anti-price gouging statute. Currently, price gouging is primarily outlawed at the state level. You know, think of the classic example. There's a hurricane, there's a mass evacuation order. One of the gas stations, you know, hikes up their gas to $20 a gallon. Mm-hmm. That's illegal. Everybody mm-hmm. understands that. We don't have a federal standard, a national standard, that would protect people in states that don't have their own price gouging statutes. So that's really important. You know, I mentioned earlier, arguably the most important thing, and you mentioned history. I think folks don't really realize that the United States was really a pioneer in taxing corporations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The corporate tax was really devised in 1909 under the Taft administration. And it wasn't necessarily devised just to raise revenue in order to spend money. Mm-hmm. Actually, at its inception, from its birth, the corporate tax rate was envisioned as a way to curb corporate power because there were big oil and tobacco monopolies and trusts, and they threatened democracy. Corporate power threatens democracy. Whenever corporations become too powerful, they wield undue influence over our you know, democratic institutions and over our democracy. And so the corporate tax was really envisioned as a way to curb that power, to supplement antitrust. And I think it's probably time to revive that spirit a bit by boosting the corporate tax rate. Taxation is probably the single most effective tool to regulate corporate behavior for a simple reason. If you know that you get to keep more of the profits, you're gonna play roulette with consumer loyalty.
Right.
You're gonna gamble with consumer loyalty. You're gonna test consumer loyalty because the reward is so high that it justifies the high risk. Yeah. But if you know that you have a high tax bill at the end of the year that you have to pay, I think you'll be a little bit more reluctant to play those games with consumers.
Right. I mean, of course, Republicans would say, well, taxation stifles innovation. It stifles, the incentives to be innovative. It stifles the economy itself by taking that money and putting it into the government and not letting it circulate around. I wonder though if obviously you and I don't believe that's true, but look at the economy right now. I mean, there are parts of the economy that are doing really well because of the stock market, for instance. If you're an investor, you're doing really well because of these, in part because of these things, right? I think it's hard to argue against the wealth that's being built, even beyond corporate boardrooms, because of all of this.
Absolutely. If folks think that shaving the corners off of a bar of soap in order to sell you a smaller bar of soap is innovation,
it's cool.
if that's the type of innovation that we're stifling, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But in terms of innovation that actually enhances people's lives and livelihoods in this country, we already had a test run of whether that happened. It was the Trump tax law.
Yeah.
In 2017, corporations got
a huge enormous tax break.
Enormous tax cut. The statutory corporate tax rate was reduced from 35% to 21%. That is historically low. And part of the way that that law was justified was that the reduction in the corporate tax rate would yield an extra $4,000 in wage increases to the average worker. Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say, that did not happen.
That didn't happen.
I don't think anyone listening to this program remembers getting a $4,000 boost.
$4,000 bonus.
Because corporate America got one of the largest, tax breaks in history. It was also enormously costly.
Mm-hmm. It blew a huge hole in the deficit.
It was the single most expensive provision in the 2017 Trump tax law. I think we could look around at our economy and we can ask the question, did that law yield this extraordinary surge in investment and innovation? Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think instead we got more price gouging.
Yeah.
We got more surveillance. We got more stock buybacks. We got higher CEO pay. I'm not a CEO.
Right.
Most people listening to those programs are not a CEO not of a large bank.
We're not seeing all that money.
Yeah, we're not seeing all that money. Yeah. So I think in 2025, the Trump tax law, large parts of the Trump tax law expire.
Yes.
This is the single most important economic policy issue of our time because the tax code is fundamentally what determines who has power in our economy and who does not.
Mm.
And when the Trump tax law expires, Congress should really use that as an opportunity to remake our tax code, to make it more fair, to make sure that it supports actual families and people and workers, because it's the workers and the ordinary people in this country that actually provide the value in the economy. We coined this phrase during the pandemic, essential workers. Mm-hmm. What happened to that?
Mm.
Was that just PR? I think workers are essential, and I think workers deserve a break, and corporations should have to pay their fair share and should have to pay their fair share such that it is expensive for them to base their business models on tricks and traps and deception that mislead consumers.
Yeah. Bilal Baydoun, I would love to continue this conversation. We're going to have you back to talk more about data, especially, and how we rein that in, but we are out of time in this episode. It was really, really great, though, to have you here to talk about all of the reasons that we're paying more and why we should maybe do things a little differently to bring those down. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Cool. Thank you, Stephen.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.